in the morning. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there's no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning. It's the 20th of September, 2023. My name is Arthur, and yes, I haven't been around for the whole summer semester. I'm going to try and give this a shot again. I've been kind of busy being a parent. Don't really have anything interesting today except the Mercury Theater Remembered. This has an unknown production date. I know Leonard Maltin is involved in this. I know I read a book in the 90s even about old time radio that he had co-authored. So I know he was a fan of the genre. So without going too much further into this, go ahead and play this again. This is the Mercury Theater Remembered. Thanks.
You know, there's been some talk here tonight about directors as though they were a separate breed. And I'm afraid I have to take exception to that. I believe that directors are all of them actors, just as I believe that most writers are actors. There never was a community of people who got together and said, why don't we have a theater? We need a theater. Where are the actors? That never happened in the history of the world. A few hams got together and said, let's get up on the stage and do something. In the cave, somebody stood up and told a story. Nobody said, let's have a story until they'd heard a story. You know.
Orson Welles knew how to tell a story. I'm Leonard Maltin, and this is a look at one of America's master storytellers. Whether on the stage, on film, or radio, Welles' great skill was to manipulate the medium in a way that seized the imagination of his audience. The golden age of radio lasted some 20 years, but the radio broadcasts of Orson Welles rank among this century's most unique artistic achievements. Richard Wilson, a member of the famed Mercury Company, recalls why radio was so special to Orson.
Radio was a favorite medium of Orson's because he knew it knew no boundaries. It was a theater of imagination. He thought of it as a gathering of people in the town square just to hear a story.
Orson Welles began his network radio career at 19. By age 23, he had simultaneously become one of radio's most accomplished performers and a top director on the Broadway stage.
In a single year, the first in the life of the Mercury Theater, Orson Welles has come to be the most famous name of our time in American drama. Says Collier's Magazine,
23-year-old Orson Welles threw a bombshell into Broadway.
Robert Benchley writes in The New Yorker,
the production of the Mercury is, I should say, just about perfect.
Time Magazine declares,
the brightest moon that has risen over Broadway in years. Welles should feel at home in the sky, for the sky is the only limit which his ambitions recognize.
Veteran actress Peggy Weber listened to Welles on radio as a child and later acted with him in radio and film. She was Lady Macduff in Welles' 1948 film version of Macbeth.
His imagination was so much more vital. He presented stories in a way that I realize today were moral and yet exciting and stimulating and beautiful. I knew that it was quality. There was nothing on the air like it. There never has been anything on the air like it. There's never been anything as good as Orson Welles' Mercury Theater.
Welles' reputation as a boy genius and his flamboyant style made him a formidable figure at this time. The young performer had so many radio and theater commitments, he needed a way to cut through the snarl of Manhattan traffic. After determining it was not illegal, the young Welles hired an ambulance to race him through New York's crowded streets with sirens blaring so he could make his next show on time. Radio and television personality Arlene Francis was a young actress who worked with Wells in the 1930s in both radio and theater.
He'd say, I think this would be better if we did it so-and-so and so-and-so, and whoever was the director from NBC or CBS or wherever we did it would bow to his wishes because, after all, he was somebody and he had already accomplished a great deal. But he was very imaginative, and his manner of forcefulness in what he had to say was powerful. I mean, you just had to pay attention, and I think it was one of the first times that radio had heard anybody with that kind of positive, able brilliance in his introduction to a play or into his understanding of the part that he was playing. He was always Orson, I will say that. Very few people argued with Orson about anything, I noticed. I noticed mostly because I wouldn't have dared, but I mean, mostly they just took his word for it, although he was always open to suggestions and talks and so forth. And I remember one time when his first wife, Virginia, said, I don't happen to think that's the right way to do that. And he said, but I do. And she had an ice cream soda in her hand in a container, and she just threw it in front of the whole company. He just mopped it up, and they went on working.
Wells' first radio series, First Person Singular, began on CBS in the summer of 1938. Its success led to the Mercury Theater on the Air and to the Campbell Playhouse series. In 2 short years, Orson Welles had left his signature on radio forever. Cliff Thorsness created sound effects on Campbell's Playhouse. He compares Welles to the conductor of a philharmonic orchestra, the leader who blended dialogue, music, and sound effects into a seamless symphony.
He was aware of the sound, the actor fading in and out, we're fading in with the actor and out. We couldn't stand there and look at our script and do a show. We had to be aware of what we were doing in the next scene because we were watching Orson. He could act a scene and direct sound. But he was physically, literally a director. He was standing on a podium and directing this. And that's why the similarity between a conductor and Orson always struck me.
A longtime member of the Mercury Company was William Allen. He played the role of Thompson, the reporter, in Welles' classic film Citizen Kane. Allen says Welles took radio drama a step further than anyone before him.
What he brought was, first of all, a complete ensemble style of performance, a completely integrated musical score, the musical bridges and transitions, which are the equivalent of fades and dissolves in film, you know, are miraculously good. In addition to that element, a real fascination with sound. Sound in radio is like lights in theater. It really is, you see. And with sound, you can do so much colorization. It's more than just a background. So that sound became a very creative part of that. And then again, you had finally an ensemble group that did not pander to the lowest common denominator of the audience, but the highest. We played classics. We did the best there is. There was no junk. It was all beautiful stuff, but done in a way with all these elements that he managed to hold the interest of kids, middle age, held the interest of everyone.
Producer and actor John Houseman, who was Welles' producing partner in the Mercury's theatrical productions, also became a partner in radio.
Well, I wrote the first shows. I wrote the first seven or eight, or no more than that, about 10 shows. The first one or two I wrote with Orson, because he taught me how to do radio shows. After that, I was sort of general editor, but I still wrote most of them. Then when our Mercury season started, this became, there was a time when I never got out of bed, because I never had time to get out of bed. So I would lie in bed and write the radio shows, lie in bed, administer the Mercury Theater, and simply because I had no time to get up.
The Wells-Houseman relationship was extremely fruitful and extended from radio to the Broadway stage to the making of Citizen Kane. But there was often turbulence between the two men. Actress Geraldine Fitzgerald remembers.
It was stormy, but they were tremendous friends, and they were of immense value to each other. Immense. Orson had very good taste, but he didn't need to have any taste at all because he was so talented. They said he was like a busted water main, his talent. And it went all over the streets and down alleys, and it filled up holes and made shapes and patterns. That was Orson. Now, John comes along, and then with buckets and dug jugs and pots and pans, he collects all this wonderful, wonderful material and allows it to have more shape than perhaps Orson would have bothered to give it. But he had too much talent to be careful of it.
Noted Broadway producer Richard Barr, who began his long career as a member of the Mercury Company, also recalls the Wells-Houseman relationship.
Orson was totally undisciplined artistically. Somewhat personally, too, but artistically, certainly. And Jack was the steadying influence, and I think Jack enjoyed that. And he certainly, we all were extraordinarily fond of Jack, as we were of Orson. But the fact is that he's the one that kept it together.
The best period of Orson was when he was with Jack Houseman.
Richard Wilson.
The reason for this, I think, is that it was predicated on the future. That they were both young. They were both still striving, still searching.
John Houseman was essential to Orson's early career. And in my opinion, it was an artistic tragedy that they broke up the partnership, because it was, in my opinion, always essential to his career. Because he needed someone to do a lot of the kind of work that he never wanted to do, never liked to do, and to deal with people that he found very difficult to deal with. And then if John had done a lot of the negotiating and so forth, then they could have a good laugh together and get on to the real thing, which was a place for the creativity of Orson Welles to flourish. Because that's all that John was ever interested in, to make that. Because he understood that he was, if not the major theatrical artist of the time, is certainly one of the greatest. There was nothing that he couldn't have done. And what was so difficult for him was getting on with the people who put it all together. You see, in the theatre, you don't really have to get on with everybody. If the worst comes to the worst, you can take your company and go out in the street and play your play there. Nobody can bother you. So that was really the position that he had at the Mercury Theatre. So they withdrew the money. So he put it on a bare stage. So they said that the Cradle Will Rock couldn't speak from the stage. So they spoke from the audience. In other words, he remained always in command. But when he got to Hollywood, because the appurtenances of filmmaking are so incredibly expensive, I mean the camera, the sound, the lights, the lab, everything, the studio space, costs millions, as you know. Therefore, you have to get along with the people who are going to get those millions. You can't take it out in the street. And that was the basic problem for him for the rest of his life. And if he could have held on to John, or John could have stood up to it all, then John could have done all that for him, as he did. But Orson began to get so frustrated about Hollywood, and to rather kind of, you know, put too much on John, too much of his frustration. So I know he once threw a table at him. John told me that he'd broken up with Orson and they were not going to produce any more together. And I said, "Well, you shouldn't do that. He is very valuable to us all, and you should put up with it." And John said, "Well, I didn't mind him throwing a table at me, but when he sets fire to the tablecloth first and then throws it, then I mind." So I said, "Well, I agree. I mean, that's a lot."
It's a vexed problem always, and not one that I have any intention of trying to solve. How much did our collaboration help Orson to achieve those very early successes of his, and why didn't they go on after the collaboration ended in a substantial way? And I don't know the answer to that.
Another valuable Mercury contributor was Bernard Herrmann. Herrmann joined the CBS music department in 1934 and was quickly recognized as a budding musical talent. 4 years later, Herrmann became composer and conductor of the CBS Orchestra on the Mercury broadcasts. It was an assignment that would thrust Bernard Herrmann to musical stardom. In an interview shortly before his death in 1975, Herrmann spoke of Wells.
Orson is an improviser. Orson hasn't one way to do anything. It's an ensemble performance. Everybody who works with Orson is part of everything. You're with him at meals, on the holidays. Your life and his become one for the time you work together. Wells was almost a precocious child when you worked with him. It was an instantaneous, intuitive understanding of what should be done.
William Allen remembers the Wells-Herrmann relationship.
The relationship was effective because Bernard Herrmann was not about, you know, to let Orson compose music for him. That's all. Bernard Herrmann knew exactly what Orson needed, you know, and he delivered what Orson needed. Now, if Orson would ask for something really outlandish, which he could do, we all can, Bernard would twirl his little head. This is with his pipe. And say, I don't know how to do that. Great life. I just don't know how to do that, Orson. So, Orson had great respect for him because he knew that Bernard could not be intimidated. You see,
what Benny did, he would have a whole repertoire of music, and it had wonderful names. I remember there was one on for any gruesome effects. There was Frozen Music. You remember, and that was always. And so, as the rehearsal went on, he'd say, "All right, we use 10 bars of Frozen Music, and then we'll use that theme and that theme." So, it was a matter of largely of selection. That doesn't mean that he didn't compose special pieces, but in general, these were pieces that he'd composed, but which were in the so-called repertory.
I like to think that both of them, and I use the term genius, I think they both were. I think Bernard Herrmann was. They just seemed to have a relationship that they thought alike, they seemed to. And the only thing I remember about Bernard Herrmann, he was very nervous, and he had a short haircut. And he'd sit there talking to Orson, and he'd twist his hair and pull. Well, I know he didn't pull a hair out every time he did this, but it was a nervous habit. And he was hardly conscious of what he was doing, actually. But it seemed like when they were together, they were just like one. And when we'd finish our rehearsing in the big studio, Orson would, or somebody would call over to the Brown Derby and order half a dozen pork chops or whatever Orson was going to eat. And they'd come in and put the linen in the music studio with the orchestra. Then Orson would work as much with Bernard Herrmann and his music and the script as he did with the cast.
Mercury rehearsals were notorious for their chaotic quality, usually a crisis-like atmosphere. But cast members also remember those times as great fun. In this rare rehearsal recording made in May 1940, we get a glimpse of Wells directing his ensemble cast for a production of Macbeth. Faye Bainter is Lady Macbeth.
We have scotched the snake, not killed it. She'll close and be herself, whilst our poor Malice remains in danger of a former tooth. But let the frame of things disjoint. Both the worlds suffer. Ere we will eat our meal in fear, and sleep in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly. Better be with the dead, whom we, to gain our peace, have sent to peace, than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Restless, restless. Goddamn son of a bitch. Excuse me, I'm very sorry. All right, once again. Restless!
You like the season of all nature. Sleep.
It will have blood, they say. Blood will have blood. Jesus Christ. I'm terribly sorry. But there's coming to our ears the sound of wild offstage laughter.
Get them away from the door.
And it isn't from here. At least go away from the door, man.
you do that?
I am a man that could use a loan of 25 cents because I don't know how I'm going to eat breakfast tomorrow, as you know.
Yeah. This is a line from Luella, who knows all.
She's all about Hollywood. A line or two, it commences. Orson Welles got himself a husky bankroll in San Francisco. And now he's talking with Laurence Olivier about going into partnership to produce stage plays.
Yippee!
Oh, God, that's funny.
You get that idea.
Yeah, that's wonderful. An idea.
Where does she make these things up?
Really? She doesn't make them up.
Close the door. Let's go. Come on, man. We're trying to work. Don't look at me in that way as though I weren't going ahead.
Then on Sunday, hell broke loose. We started at 8 in the morning and rehearsed like mad all day. Then, as I remember it, we'd have a sort of run-through rehearsal, Orson directing it naturally and acting in it and giving the cues, and that would happen probably around noon or 1 o'clock. Finally, we'd have a dress rehearsal. And then the great discoveries would be made as to how long or short we were. This was not as much of a problem as one would think, because Orson had an unbelievable capacity for stretching or hurrying shows. I mean, he was such a past master of radio that he could add or just subtract 15 minutes from an hour show without major difficulty. Once in a while, we did have major difficulty. Were you around when Man Who Was Thursday? Well, Man Who Was Thursday was Orson's favorite novel. And so he said, we're going to do Man Who Was Thursday. And he said, I don't want any of you houseman, I don't want your coarse hands touching this work. I shall write this work myself. Wonderful, Orson. Great. So about a week went by. And Orson, have you got a script? Can we have a script? No, I'm working on it. Don't bother me. Don't hurry me. This is my thing I'm really fond of. This is my show that I love. Well, we arrived on the Saturday, and there was no show. Not a word. He'd not written a word. He'd marked a few scenes in pencil. So, now we were in desperate, and we sat down, and we sort of, with a paste pot and scissors, and Orson choosing his favorite scenes, he knew the play, the book very, very well. He really loved it. So we sort of started putting a show together, but even that was slow work, because Orson hated to lose anything or whether to add anything. And anyhow, we went into the rehearsal, and the whole thing was, we never had a script. It was all sort of patches, pieces of papers stuck together. And we went into the dress rehearsal, and we discovered that we were 22 minutes short. 22 minutes. Well, that was more than even Orson could handle. And so we had a wonderful idea. I don't know if it was Orson's idea or mine, but what happened is while they were sort of doing their rehearsal, I ran down to the library at CBS, and I collected it was the end of the season. We were getting ready to announce our new season. So I rushed down to the library, got all these books. They were books I knew that Orson and I both liked and admired, so I wasn't too worried about that. So I brought up this pile of books, and then we just sat there, and we were on the air by this time. And I would hand Orson one of these books with a mark, and Orson would read it brilliantly and say, that is the kind of entertainment we're going to give you next season. Next! And then I'd hand him another book, and he'd read another passage, and so we filled 22 minutes. And it was a wonderful show, and the network was enchanted. They said, that is a really wonderful trailer. That's the kind of thing we should have more of, that kind of thing.
Wells also had a flair for the practical joke, which he often used to terrify network executives or even members of his own Mercury company. Geraldine Fitzgerald and Richard Wilson recall two such memorable incidents.
He had a habit when he was broadcasting on radio of having a spare script, not attached to any book and not attached to any kind of clips. Mm-hmm. So in other words, just the papers were loose. And as a matter of fact, I think we all did that so that we could turn the pages more easily. But just before the countdown, he would suddenly pretend to be unusually elated or unusually incensed, and he would fling all the script up into the air, so it all fell to the ground, so that he when the executive officers had gone into the booth now, this is the first time they'd seen what was going to happen, they thought he's going to have to go on without a script. But he hadn't really had another one. He just wanted to give them a fright.
It was 1940. I've always had a very short fuse, and I'd been arrested in Burbank because the police department, well, I'd refused to give them my driver's license number. And I spent several hours in jail. They gave me that one traditional phone call, and I called Orson, and I asked for bail, and he came through. Well, at our next rehearsal of the Campbell Playhouse, this was in Hollywood, Orson was conducting rehearsals. And suddenly the doors burst open, a bunch of uniformed policemen entered the studio, and one of them said, "Do you have a Richard Wilson here? We have a warrant for his arrest." Well, by this time, I'm hiding behind some chairs and stuff in the back corner of the studio. Then Orson broke up. Everybody broke up. You see, Orson had hired some extras, rented some police uniforms for them, and he'd ordered them to come to the studio and scare the hell out of me. Everybody was in on the joke but me. Of course, Orson took great delight in this and had gotten back for my calling him for bail.
Realistic sound effects were an important element of radio drama. Wells took a very personal interest in the quality and accuracy of the sound effects used in the Mercury broadcast.
You remember, we spent at least 3 hours of valuable time experimenting on what would sound most like a severed head for Tale of Two Cities. And I think the final decision was a cabbage. They would put a cleaver through a cabbage and then drop it into the basket.
During the Campbell Playhouse broadcast, we were broadcasting from a place called Liederkranz Hall. And it was an ancient turn-of-the-century building with lots of toilets and urinals and so forth. And Orson, for the program Les Miserables, put a microphone in there to represent the sewers of Paris, because all the johns and the urinals leaked, dripped, and so forth. Somebody made his way through, and on the program, on a coast-to-coast broadcast, we heard this toilet flushing, and the man had done his whole thing, and that went out over the national broadcast. Orson, as usual, had all his headphones on to monitor all the sound, and he heard this, and the look on his face was extraordinary. It was incredible.
Of course, the most famous of the Mercury broadcasts was H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds on Halloween Eve, 1938. It was the program that scared the nation and propelled the young Orson Welles onto the front pages of the nation's newspapers.
We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening.
The show itself was one of those miracles. It just happens to be a very, very good script. And everybody pitched in. I mean, the actors, the famous story of the man who was playing the reporter who went downstairs and played the Hindenburg record over and over and over, and then virtually reproduced it in a different context.
It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Ah! Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere, coming this way.
But the man who was to read the Secretary of the Interior, he really pulled a very fast one on us, because he could imitate Roosevelt's voice perfectly. And I don't know to what degree Orson or I or anybody was aware that he was going to use that voice, but he did. And of course, it was one of the most damning and effective things in the show.
Citizens of the nation,
I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action.
But the whole atmosphere in that studio was absolutely electric. I mean, everybody suddenly realized that there was a chance to do a wonderful show, and the very similitude of it, of course, was very important, and that was our main preoccupation. And then Orson himself made an enormous contribution, because the beginning of that show, you've heard it many times, I'm sure, is very boring. It's supposed to be. That was the whole trick. But Orson emphasized that, and Orson carried that a step much further than we would have had the nerve to do, anybody, Stuart or anybody else. So that in the beginning, you have these terribly slow scenes and these long pauses and then these Chopin piano solos. And the fact is that by about 13 minutes into the show, something had to happen because the show was so boring that it was not possible that a show would be. And then very slowly, it started to accelerate, which explains why people believed it. Because the fact is that if you accelerate as cleverly as that, as well as that, people don't notice that suddenly you're covering the incidents that would take a day, and you're covering it in 5 minutes. And that's one of the magic things about radio, that you can create that illusion and that suspension of disbelief. And Orson was largely contributing to that.
As War of the Worlds aired, Arlene Francis was in rehearsals for Wells' stage production of Danton's Death. She remembers Wells arriving at the theater after the broadcast.
And so we used to rehearse at the theater until, you know, midnight or later. And Orson came from that broadcast, and he burst into the we were all waiting for him, and he burst into the auditorium and said, "I don't know what's going to happen. The police are going to be after me. I know all hell has broken loose now because of the fact that I had this War of the Worlds done so well that they really thought it was going on." And he came in. He couldn't believe the reaction to it. None of us could, you know. But we all stayed there a long time, and he was talking about it, and he was... he said, "It's nothing. They made such a big thing out of nothing. How could they do that? How are people so silly as to believe a thing like that? And in the first place, they hear my voice, they don't think I'm going to be the one to announce a war between the worlds."
We were opposite Charlie McCarthy. Not the senator, but the wooden doll. That was the other network. And Roosevelt sent a telegram the next day saying, "This only goes to prove that all intelligent people are listening to Charlie McCarthy." He said that.
I was in the control room, and sitting next to the CBS, our supervisor, who's Davidson Taylor, quite a well-known figure later, ran Columbia Performing Arts. And he got a call and suddenly got up and left rather precipitately. And then he came back about 3 minutes later, white as a sheet, said, "We got to stop the show. We got to stop." We ran over our first half instead of breaking at 28 minutes. We ran about 35, and I remember the Dave said, "John, you've got to stop the show. You've got to stop it." And I interposed my body between him and Orson and said, "No, no, never, never. You can't ruin the show." So he wasn't terribly strong character, and he was not a brutal character, so he sort of stood there helplessly, and for about another 5 minutes we went on until we finished the show. Then as soon as we finished the show, I or David or somebody went up to Orson and said, "Look, you've got to make an explanation, because this hell has broken loose, right? And I can't tell you what, but just make an explanation." So he made his set speech, which was all about Halloween. "Oh, that was our little Halloween joke," and so on, so on. But by then, I'd had calls in the control room from governors of states, and not to me, but I mean to the show, saying, "What is this? If this is a joke, we're coming down, and we're going to punch you in the nose." I mean, this was some governor of Iowa or somewhere. And then the second half of the show went on. Well, by then, the second hour of the show is totally uncontroversial. It's pure H.G. Wells, and it's the two last survivors on the Earth after the by accident they've survived. But by then, of course, everybody was rushing around. Nobody was listening. Then when it was over, CBS sent dozens of house police into the studio. They snatched all the scripts, and they hustled Orson and me into some room, some back room, and they kept us there for about half an hour. Then the press was released to us, and they behaved dreadfully. But the press was very sore at radio. Radio had displaced them as the prime news medium, and they were very sore. So they made the most of it. They would do things like, well, you've heard about the family of five that was killed on the New Jersey highway. Have you heard any more around the country? And they would all pull things like that. So that we believed for the next two or three hours that we were mass murderers.
As the days wore on, the perception of the War of the Worlds broadcast was transformed from a disaster to an artistic triumph. Within weeks, the Campbell Soup Company became Orson Welles' radio sponsor.
I guess they figured if Orson could make the War of the Worlds credible and the Martians credible, he could make Campbell's chicken soup credible. So we became the Campbell Playhouse.
Of all the reasons for Orson Welles' extraordinary success with radio, William Allen feels a key factor was in Welles' own insecurities about his acting ability.
I think that when it came to Orson's acting, you know, his first instinctive performance was always better than his 10th rehearsed one, you see. Because after the first he would start listening to himself and doubting himself. He never really had, in my view, real confidence in himself as an actor. He never really felt that he was really a good actor, which is why he felt the most comfortable and the most secure when he was padded with noses and putty and bellies so that the real Orson could be hidden deep in there. His problem was, as an actor, he never learned to or never could do that tremendously difficult juggling act that a great actor can do, which is to have absolute control of a performance and know what you're doing and at the same time feel, have the passion of it too, you see. And Orson had found it very difficult to be somebody other than Orson, yet at the same time have control of that character.
Radio was the only medium that imposed a discipline that Orson would recognize. And that was the clock. When it came time for the Mercury to go on the air, there was no denying it. I can't think of one theater production ever that was not postponed. But radio, he knew every week that clock was ticking. That red light would come on and say, on the air. And good or bad, right or wrong, boy, that was it. It was the only discipline Orson was able ever to accept.
Radio's golden age was a mere blip in time. It lasted some 20 years, pushed aside by television. But from this mass medium came something unique, a form of theater that stimulated the individual imagination, that caused the audience to contribute to the storytelling process. Actress Peggy Weber remembers the time when radio was a dominant force in American life.
Well, radio was our main source of entertainment. It was our main contact with the rest of the world. It was immediate. It was happening right at the time we were hearing it live. It was exciting, as it is today, to see a stage production. And television, I feel, has robbed us of that opportunity to contribute as an audience.
Ironically, or perhaps appropriately, Orson Welles never really came to terms with television. When radio drama faded from the American scene, it closed a glorious chapter in Welles' career.
Thanks for listening. And until next time, I remain as always, obediently yours. Thank you.
Yep, that's... I think remembering Orson Welles. The Mercury Theater remembered. Again, I don't have an unknown production date. It could have been in 1988. I'm not sure. Like I said, initially, Leonard Maltin was involved. And he was, he chronicled some of this old golden age of radio. Yeah. Sorry. It's been a while, so I'm, catching up. My name is Arthur, and you're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio, and or WMFO.org. Time for a PSA.
My husband had a gun. Him and his friends would go shooting. When he stored the gun, he didn't know. In a million years, we never thought that Emily could. There's a hole in our family that can never, ever be filled.
65 Americans a day die by gun suicide. Safe gun storage saves lives. Learn more at infamilyfire.org. Brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
Thank you, Ad Council, for the second, well, for the last quarter of the show. I'm going to play Adventures in Research. This is The Sting of Death, starring Mosquitoes, which I personally don't have an issue with. This had an original air date of the 3rd of December, 1946. My name is Arthur. Thanks for listening.
Adventures in Research.
Doctor, excuse please, officer, doctor.
Well, what is it, man? Speak up.
Little boy very sick. Please, must come quick to fix him.
Sick, eh? What's wrong with him?
Very hot with fever. Very sick. Very hot, but shake like very cold.
Well, we'll have a look at him. Sounds to me like it might be malaria.
This is Paul Shannon introducing another in the series of programs dealing with the thrilling adventures to be found in the field of scientific research, as told by the men of science themselves. Today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, is called The Sting of Death. It is more than just the story of a man and the work he did. It is a tribute to the toil, the faith, and the unending perseverance of those whose lives are devoted to research, that their fellow men may benefit from their trials and their successes. Such a man was Sir Ronald Ross, Major Ronald Ross of the Indian Medical Service, back in the year 1894.
No, no, Captain, I can't say that I agree with you. I've observed patients with malarial fever for some time.
But, Major Ross, what other proof exists? If the disease isn't caused by drinking water, or possibly, as some believe, the dank night air of the tropics, what else can it be?
It might be carried by mosquitoes.
Oh, nonsense. Simply because Manson discovered that the filaria worm that causes elephantiasis is carried by the mosquito, you and a lot of others are coming to the belief that it's the cause of innumerable jungle diseases. I say, you're getting off on a tangent. You can't blame the mosquito for everything, you know.
That's how it was. Always they wanted to hold to the old theories. Malaria caused by the dank night air or by the drinking water. On Ross's next leave back home to England, he determined to see Patrick Manson and see what his theories on the subject might be.
Now, Dr. Ross, have a look in that microscope and tell me what you see.
Let me adjust it a little. Well, the usual cells of the blood, the plasma. Here, what's this? A small round affair with a definite black pigmentation in the center.
Right you are, Dr. Ross. That is the parasite of malaria that you're looking at. The parasite discovered first by Laveran.
So, this is the little fellow that does the damage.
You'll only find that in the blood of people with malaria. Of that you may be sure. But the big puzzle is...
How does it get from person to person?
Right. How is malaria spread?
That was the important question. Many times during his leave in England, Ross, with Manson, observed malarial patients in the hospitals there, pricked the fingers of sailors stricken with tropical malaria, smeared the samples of blood on their microscope slides, and watched the growth, the action of the deadly malaria parasites.
There are the spheres, Dr. Ross.
I see them. Tiny things they are. Inside the red blood cells.
Now watch them. The little spheres break through the cell wall. See that?
Yeah.
When that happens, the victim has his chill.
There they are again, in this other smear. No, they're larger, crescent-shaped. And those long whips extending from them make them look like an octopus.
Yes, as fearful and deadly an octopus as ever menaced the waters of the tropical seas.
Ross watched, amazed at the spectacle that was going on beneath his gaze. Still, he said nothing of his theory of how malaria might be carried from a sick man to one who was well. And then, one day, as he and Dr. Manson walked along Oxford Street, the elder man suddenly stopped.
Ross?
Yes, Dr. Manson?
Ross, I've an idea about malaria.
Then, what's that?
I've an idea that those parasites we've been watching are carried by mosquitoes.
You really believe it?
I do indeed. A victim sick with malaria lies feverish in his bed. The mosquito lights upon him, bites him, and in biting, sucks up some of his blood, which is filled with the malaria parasites, the crescents. Then, once those crescents get into the mosquito's stomach, they turn into spheres with a black pigment. Then out go those wriggling whips that find their way into the hide of the mosquito.
Then what, Dr. Manson?
Then they must turn into some form of bacillus. And the mosquito dies. 9 times out of 10, that mosquito will fall into some water. Then unfortunate people come along and drink that very water, the water the mosquito has caused to be infected. From man to mosquito to man, that's malaria.
Back from his leave now, to the post he held in India, went Ross. In the lonely military station of Secunderabad, on a great desolate plain heaped with piles of ugly rock, Ross followed the trail of the mosquito.
Lachman! Lachman! Where is that man? Lachman!
Yes, Sahib. You called?
Go out again. Bring me more mosquitoes.
But, Sahib, the ones you had...
I've cut them all up. I need more.
Yes, Sahib. I get more mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes by the tens... By the hundreds, Ross's servant, Lutchman, captured. Miserable, malarious men in great numbers, Ross paid to let the mosquito bite them. Then, in the hot hole that served as his laboratory, Ross peered into the stomachs of those mosquitoes, into every flimsy portion of their tiny bodies, probed through the magnifying eye of the microscope for the parasites, and found the disheartening answer to his research. A parasite didn't grow.
Something's wrong. Something. They're in the blood, those parasites. The mosquito sucks them into his system. And they die there. The heat of this place is enough to drive a man crazy. How can men live in it? How can... Wait a moment, Ross, old boy. You're getting off the track. Get back to the mosquitoes. Forget the heat. Water. And maybe that's what it really is. Parasite-infected mosquitoes... in the drinking water. That's what Dr. Manson said, too. Lutchman! Lutchman!
Yes, Sahib? More mosquitoes?
Yes, more mosquitoes.
More mosquitoes. More men with malaria to pass the parasite on. Then 2 bottles of water for the infected mosquitoes to swim in. After that, the test.
You 3 men, I want you to understand what you're doing. I don't have to explain much to you, Lutzman. You've been through this with me.
Yes, Sahib.
I'm paying you to drink this water. There were mosquitoes with malaria swimming in it until this morning. I took them out. If you drink that water, you might get malaria. Mm. Understand that? You might get malaria.
Yes, Sahib. We
now,
understand.
You do get malaria. I have the medicine here. Plenty of it. It will take the fever and chills away. What you're going to do is for science. Understand? It's for the whole world. It's important. If you don't want to play along, just say so. I won't force you to. Anybody want to quit?
We drink it, Sahib.
We drink water.
Fine. Thank you, men.
Well, they drank the brew from Ross's mosquito swimming pool. Then they waited, while Ross sampled their blood beneath his well-worn microscope. The hours ticked by, and they waited for the chill and the fever. But it never came. The water wasn't the carrier of malaria. Failure after failure passed across the microscope stage. And Ross worked so hard that when he finished in the late afternoon, nearly blind with squinting, he could only stumble to his quarters and, wrapped in fatigue, find comfort in heavy sleep.
New kind of mosquito. Sahib be glad to get this, maybe. Don't try to fly away. You with the colored wings. Ah, more of your family, too. Good, good. Wait till Sahib Ross see you.
Who's there? Oh, it's you, Lutzman.
Look, Sahib. Fine new kind of mosquito. Very different from plain ones before.
What's this? A new kind? Yeah, let's have it. Oh, yes. Dapple-winged fellow. This is new. Can you get more like it?
Find some, Sahib. Don't know. Maybe find more.
Find them. Find more. We'll start all over with these.
Start all over. Begin at the beginning again. August 16th, 1897. Ross makes the entries in his notebook.
New type mosquito with dapple wings found. Allowed them to bite malaria patient calm. Wait results. Dissected several of the new mosquitoes which bit patient Khan. Results. No evidence of parasites anywhere.
Bit by bit he hunts through the mosquito with the same wearying result. Till nothing remains to be checked but the stomach. Groggy, tired, Ross pushes the microscope away from himself in a gesture of disgust.
Oh, the devil.
And then, in a single moment, makes the choice between success and failure. Reaches again for the microscope, rubs his hand across his eyes, and looks down. There's the corpuscle, the blood cell, a turn of the microscope screw, and...
What's this? Clear circular outline, too sharp for a blood cell, and too small. There's another. Focus sharper. Yes, yes. Granules of that black pigment, and more. 3, 5, 9, 12. 12 of them. No, my eyes are playing me tricks. It's the heat I'm seeing things. I'd better get some sleep.
Right you are, Dr. Ross. That is the parasite, the malaria that you're looking at. The parasite first discovered by Laver.
So, this is the little fellow that does the damage. Oh, yes. And there's another. Again, with a black pigment in the center.
You'll only find that in the blood of people with malaria. Of that you may be sure. But the big puzzle is, how is malaria spread?
How is it spread? The mosquito? No, I can't find the parasite there. The mosquito doesn't get it in the blood of the patient.
As though in a dream, Ross awoke with the answer. No, his eyes weren't playing him tricks. He did see those pigmented parasites in the mosquito stomach.
I must go back now. I know they'll still be there. I know it.
Yes, they were there all right. Those malaria parasites were there, alive and growing. And there were more in mosquitoes that came after. The answer was clear. The fact was sure. The proof that the bite of the Anopheles mosquito was the sting of death. The starting point in the trip of the malaria parasite from a sick man to a well one. For the blessing his toil brought to mankind, great honor came to Sir Ronald and to his colleague, Sir Patrick Manson, who pointed the way and encouraged him from England miles away. And to Ronald Ross, in 1902, came that distinguished honor, the Nobel Prize for Medicine. And yet, no prize could ever repay Sir Ronald Ross for the great good he did in the name of humanity through his historic adventure in research. The Sting of Death, the story you have just heard, is another in the series of Adventures in Research by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. Be with us again next week for another interesting story by Dr. Thomas on Adventures in Research.
Yes, Adventures in Research, the Westinghouse, the Sting of Death, with the original air date of the 3rd of December, 1946. Well, that was after World War II, wasn't it? My name is Arthur, and you are listening to the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org. Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. I'd just like to say thanks to the executive board for allowing the Grand Hour to continue. Anybody listening, we'll be back next week. However, I might be training somebody, so we probably won't. We'll have some radio dramas for sure next week, but I don't know about the ensuing week. Again, thank you for listening.
Cheers.